That you probably found as you were working through the project. So if you're just joining on the recording, not much you've missed, but basically here are some things that I think you found, and correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know what your background is, but if you come into finance or accounting or valuation, often you think there are lots of facts on the ground. You mistake accounting numbers for facts. And what I think you might have discovered as you've gone through this project is there are very few facts, lots of opinions. Even those accounting numbers in your last annual report, your financial statements, are opinions, they're not facts. And as you looked across services, you noticed how much disagreement there was on basic numbers. So for instance, if you took S&P Capital IQ, Yahoo Finance, and your own company's annual reports, they disagreed on very basic things like revenues. For some of your companies, the revenues would match. And with the macro numbers like risk-free rates and risk premiums, all bets are off because basically the numbers are all over the place. So that's something you probably discovered. It probably frustrated you, but it's something that in a sense you've got to get used to in finance and business. The second is the real world is a messy place. And I don't have to remind you after a quarter, after the last couple of months, because you might have picked a company that was a money-making company. You followed my instructions, but by the time you got to actually looking at the numbers, your company might have become a money loser. In fact, if you did an airline, when you started this process, Alicia, your mic is open. You have a question? Okay. Your money-making company might have become a money-losing company. Companies can be restructured. They do acquisitions. They do divestitures. In fact, I describe this project as trying to nail Jell-O to a wall, because just like when you think you've got numbers under control, the numbers change on you. The third is I did give you a few black boxes and spreadsheets or ask you to do the optimal debt ratio and the valuation. I know that when you do these spreadsheets, some of it seemed like a black box. You entered numbers and something popped out. I'll be quite honest with you. There's nothing magical about these spreadsheets. You could build them on your own. The only reason I do it is to prevent you from spending the bulk of your semester becoming an Excel ninja. But as you work through these models, one of the things I hope you recognize is these models are tools. They just take the numbers you input and they convert them into values or into optimal debt ratios. So when you see a number that doesn't make sense coming out as output, I know many of you email saying, what's wrong with your spreadsheet? And there might be things wrong with my spreadsheet. Often it was a number you inputted that drove that value. And finally, change is a constant. This is something that you just have to get used to. And in business, that's always the case, is when you take things like cost of capital, the cost of capital today might not be the cost of capital a year from now. A project that you take that you think is a good project today can very quickly become a bad project. So with that structure, let's talk a little bit about where this project started. Okay? In fact, before I start, I want to show you the companies that you pick most frequently. If you haven't realized it already, I didn't constrain people to pick unique companies. John, you have a question or is it your mic just open? The most analyzed company this semester was Netflix. 9 of you chose Netflix, 7 chose Activision Blizzard, 6, I mean, you can look at the list. And Lululemon, I don't know what it is about this company. For whatever reason, people seem to be obsessed with this company. Semester after semester after semester, Lululemon shows up as one of the top analyzed companies. Electronic Arts, Take-Two Interactive, Activision Blizzard. Tells me a lot about what you're doing with your spare time. So as you look at these companies, you see a lot of companies being picked more than once. Okay? So, John, I think I'm going to mute you. I think you're on. Somebody's unmuted. Okay. So, but here's why I don't step in and stop you from picking the same company. Take Activision Blizzard. 7 of you analyze the company. No 2 of you ended up with exactly the same numbers. On some, you can see why, right? For instance, a corporate governance measure, there's a degree of subjective judgment you got to make. 2 of you decided that Activision Blizzard shareholders are no power. 5 decided they have some power. That you can understand. The Jensen's alpha is a little trickier. I mean, there's one outlier here, and you can see which one it is, 153.96%. It might be a typo, maybe you wanted to enter 1.54%. I've just taken the numbers you've entered. But that there is something about that regression for on that one group where you're getting a 59% R squared. Don't go back and fix any numbers, but you can already see that even though it's the same company, the numbers are all over the place. In fact, if you look at the only number where there seems to be some consistency is the price per share. It's about $73. But take a look at the values per share. The range from $17 to $87. There's a reason I think we come to different judgments. And as we go through, we can maybe see what those judgments are, but you can see that even with the same company, there's an immense amount of disagreement across people who did the same company. So let's talk a little bit about where this class started. If you remember, we spent almost four sessions, and I know some of you were impatient as we went through this, talking about where the power lies in a company. And we talked about four linkages. We said stockholders often have little control over managers, and managers put their interests over stockholders. That bondholders, if they lend money to companies and they don't protect themselves, will often get ripped off. Remember the Nabisco story. And managers often try to delay bad news, sometimes even cover up bad news. And markets often make mistakes. They're not efficient. The Elvis Presley test still applies. And finally, companies create significant social costs. So we talked about the four linkages because it is my view that much of what you observe in a company comes from looking at those linkages. So as you looked at these companies, I asked you a question. I asked you, and this is a very subjective question. In your company, do stockholders have no power, some power, or lots of power? 0, 1, 2. I know it's a very, very discreet judgment on something that might be a little more varied, but here's what you found. In 17% of your companies, shareholders you concluded shareholders had no power. In 75% of your companies, you concluded that they had some power. In 8% of your companies, they have lots of power. And your companies covered the spectrum. There were emerging market companies, US companies, large companies, small companies. So you can already see that the name of the game in corporations is, in spite of everything you read, much of the power still less with aggressive managers. Shareholders have some power, but not have a whole lot of power. You know, Wendy, you have a question or is your mic just open? Yeah. So when you look at where the power lies, that was where I was asking, and that's what all of those questions about looking at the board of directors and who the investors of your company. But essentially, you know, the end game here was where does the power lie? Because if the power lies with managers, we know what's going to happen in terms of how they pick projects, how they finance them, how they pay dividends. And that's why it's so important to start with this question. Any questions on the corporate governance part? Because I know, again, that you had a lot of, you know, subjective judgments to make. And in some of your companies, you had a tough time finding information about where the power lay. And I told you that the absence of information is often as critical as finding out something. Rukshan?
Just a quick kind of benchmark. Could you give us like a flavor of what it looks like when there's absolutely no power?
When you have absolutely no power, I mean, I'll give you examples. Voting shares and non-voting shares, right? If Google or Facebook, I didn't check on those, but one of the things I do after I get the full projects is I check to see whether there's a correlation between no power. Family-controlled companies in emerging markets, companies with voting shares and non-voting shares, where the voting shares are held entirely by the founder, those tend to be the companies where you have absolutely no power. And where the companies where you have lots of power, usually you have an activist investor in the midst, or you have a founder, family member as one of the leading stockholders and the managers of the company.
Thank you.
Now, the second question I asked you is, who's the marginal investor in your stock? Do you remember why this mattered? Why do I care who the marginal investor is? Anybody?
On the CAPM model?
If your marginal investor is diversified, and that's why I said, is it an institutional investor? If it's an institutional investor, you can make the assumption, a reasonable one, that that investor is diversified. And if that investor is diversified, then you focus only on the risk you cannot diversify away. Every single risk and return model in finance, it's not just the CAPM, the arbitrage pricing model, the multi-factor model, Finance, as we know it, much of the theory was designed for companies with diversified investors. That's why this question matters so much. And for most of you, the answer, in fact, I was checking over the list of marginal investors that you sent in. I think all except what, maybe 20 companies, your marginal investor was an institutional investor. And in fact, in spring of 2019, I took their projects after I'd read all the projects and I broke it down. And this kind of gives you a flavor of the kinds of companies where you might see an individual or an insider show up as your marginal investor. Smaller companies, emerging market companies, you're more likely to see. And you think, what do I do if that happens? Remember how we computed a total beta and a total cost of equity for Bookscape because the owner was not diversified? You might have to take the CAPM or the arbitrage pricing model or the multi-factor model and add something to it to come up with the right cost of equity if your marginal investor acts like a private business owner. So something to keep in mind, not an issue with most of your companies, but it can become an issue if investors are not diversified. So that's the marginal investor part. And then I asked you about your cost of equity. If you think about what goes into cost of equity, you first have to make a judgment on what currency you're going to do your analysis. Now, we went through this in class, but again, I think there's still some confusion. So let me review again how you pick a currency. You don't have to pick the currency of the country your company's incorporated in. You don't have to pick the currency that your shares are traded in. So if you have Alibaba traded on the NASDAQ in US dollars, you don't have to do your analysis in dollars. You know what the rule with currencies is? Pick a currency. Doesn't matter what the currency is, and stay consistent. Consistent in what sense? Everything you do in your project has to be driven by that currency choice. To begin with, your risk-free rate has to be in that currency. Well, that's easy, right? Well, if you're doing an analysis in US dollars or in euros, it might be easy. You look up a 10-year government bond rate, that becomes your risk-free rate. But if you're doing an analysis in an emerging market currency, there was work for you to do. In what sense? You start with the government bond rate and you cleaned it up. You cleaned it up for the default risk in that government currency. So you're doing an Indian rupee risk-free rate. You could not just take the government bond rate and use that as your risk-free rate because it was default risk. So the way currency plays out is the risk-free rate from which you build your cost of equity, your cost of capital, will be different depending on the currency choice you make. The beta comes from what choices you make as a business, what kind of business you're in. The more discretionary your business, the higher your beta. How much fixed cost you have? Higher fixed costs lead to higher betas. And how much debt you have? Your financial leverage. And your risk premium reflects where you do business. So every number in your cost of equity has a role to play. The risk-free rate reflects your currency choice. Your beta reflects the business of businesses you operate in. Your equity risk premium reflects the geographies you're operating in. And those three choices drive your cost of equity. So let's look at the beta number. When you think about beta, the beta that you see for your company will often reflect the regression that you ran if you use traditional finance. And in the regression, the slope of the line is the beta. And we talked about two other pieces of output from that regression. One is the R squared, which tells you the proportion of the risk in your stock that comes from the market, and that's not diversifiable. And the second is the intercept, and the intercept allows you to compute your Jensen's alpha, how well or badly your stock did after adjusting for market risk and market performance. I know some of you did not print off your Bloomberg beta and you had to do a little more work to get to the R squares and the intercept, but not a big deal. It's not rocket science. But the slope tells you what the beta is. The R square tells you where the risk is coming from. And the intercept becomes a measure of performance when you compare it to the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta. But that's a top-down beta. And I talked about all the terrible things that can go wrong with regression betas. I talked about how it's one slice of history. It's a noisy estimate. How can it be affected by the index? And I think I made my biases pretty clear that I don't trust a single regression beta. And I offered you an alternative, which I'm not suggesting you have to take. In fact, after this class, if you abandon and go back to regression beta, it's your choice to make. I said, build up to a beta for your company based on the businesses the firm is in. Remember how we did this for Disney? We broke Disney down into 5 businesses. We went and looked up the beta for each business. And then we took a weighted average of those unlevered betas for each business. sounds like a lot of work. And if you had to do it all from scratch, maybe it is, but you don't have to do it from scratch every time. Once you've got the unlevered beta for different businesses, it's as easy, perhaps even easier than doing the regression beta. And once you get the unlevered beta for your company, I said, bring in your company's leverage, its debt to equity ratio and its tax rate. And you have flexibility. If you feel your company's debt to equity ratio will change, you can bring in that expected debt to equity ratio or tax rate to come up with a levered beta. So the choice of top-down versus bottom-up beta, I left for you. Now, I don't know what choice you made. And I ask you to give the choice. Maybe I should have in that Google Shared spreadsheet. But every semester, I give people this choice. And when I look at your projects, I look to see what choices people made. And last semester, in spring of 2019, the choices were as follows. My guess is it'll be pretty similar this semester as well. 89% of the beta estimates used across, I think last semester there were 260 people in the class, 89% of the 260 people used bottom-up betas. Hey, my sales pitch worked, I guess. 9% used regression betas, 2% used some other betas. I couldn't even know what they did. It was a beta that came out of nowhere. But among those people who used regression betas, I'll give you the reasons that were used, because some of you might have used regression betas and might have used one of these three reasons. The first was their company was so unusual that they could not find comparable companies. The second is their company was in only one line of business and therefore didn't pay to use a bottom-up beta. They said there's no payoff. The third is that their bottom-up beta was too different from regression betas. Rukshan?
I just wanted to check quickly if the way that you knew whether which one we'd used was whether it came from the sheet that you had updated in January. Yeah.
Actually, it came from looking at your report, because in the report, when you talked about your cost of equity, the group would say, this is what we got as a regression beta, this is what you got as a bottom-up beta. And then when they did that cost of equity in the report, they went back to regression beta. So as I read the report, I just kept tabs. It didn't have to match up to my numbers. But because they reported the regression beta in an earlier table and then they showed the bottom-up beta, I could see exactly which one got used in the calculations when they did the cost of equity and capital.
Noted. Thank you.
Now, let me ask you a question. Let's take each of these reasons. You know, if you use this reason, I'd love for you to explain why you use this reason. One is your company is unique. You cannot find comparable companies. Anybody use that reason for using the regression beta this semester? No? I'll be quite honest, I've never used that reason. And the reason is actually, the rationale is very simple. I don't think there are unique companies. I'll give you an example. I know somebody early on in the semester was doing Uber in the valuation class, emailed me and said, I cannot get a bottom-up beta for Uber because there are only two ride-sharing companies, Uber and Lyft. And that's true, right? There are only two publicly traded ride-sharing companies. If you define your business as ride-sharing, your sample size gets really small. But if you define your business as car service or logistics, your business gets much bigger. So I'm glad nobody used this rationale, but if you ever run into a scenario where you cannot get enough companies to do a bottom-up beta, either go broaden your definition of the business or go global, right? Either way, you can get a bigger sample. What about the second reason? Let's say your company is only in the steel business. Is that a good reason for using the regression beta, or does the rationale for using bottom-up beta still apply, even if you're in a single business? Anybody?
I think you still get the law of large numbers if you use the bottom-up beta approach.
David, you're absolutely right. In fact, even if you're in a single business, the rationale for bottom-up beta is never the weighting across business. It's the law of large numbers that you get a smaller standard error. So even if you're in only one business, it's not a good reason for using a regression beta. And finally, I know some of you were troubled by the fact that your bottom-up beta was very different from your regression beta. How do I know? I got your emails early on in the semester, maybe midway through the semester, saying, my regression beta is 0.7, my bottom-up beta is 2.1, or vice versa. Should I be worried? And I send exactly the same response to every single one of those emails. I said, the only time we use bottom-up betas is they're similar to regression betas or close to them. Why would we ever bother doing bottom-up betas? It's precisely because the two numbers are going to yield different answers sometimes if we only use bottom-up betas. And when they're different, here's where the law of large numbers drives me. I ran one single slice of history and got a number, and I got 100 slices of history and got a different number. I'm going to go with the bottom-up beta when the numbers are very different. I'm setting you up for a debate you're going to have after you graduate, when you're in a corporate finance team or working at a company, where people are going to use a regression beta, and you're going to say that we should use bottom-up betas because you think it's better. And they're going to say, but that's so different. Your number is so different from mine. You have to think of ways of explaining intuitively why the bottom-up beta is first different from the regression beta, and second, why it still makes sense to go with the bottom-up beta. Because if you don't, they're going to continue to use regression betas. So any questions about the beta approach before I show you what you've found?
Question.
Go ahead, Perry.
So I agree in principle with you and like applying the bottom-up paper, but what if you have a company like Tesla, which is like very high risk, and it's not a lot of risk is coming from the debt, and like you have like a manager who's swaying the market. How do you factor that risk factor in?
Okay, Barry, you've set up a great softball question. Somebody wanted to take that up. Why Tesla is, and I'm glad you picked Tesla. Tesla has execution risk, it has CEO risk. I mean, come on, there's Elon Musk tweeting out, every week, and forget about the name of his kid. I mean, every time he tweets out, right? So should my beta reflect that risk? First, what type of risk, Barry, let me put you back on the spot. What kind of risk is beta designed to carry?
Okay, market-specific risk, got it.
It's market-specific risk. Now, do some of Musk's tweets help me as a Tesla stockholder?
Yes.
So execution risk, management risk, all of that risk in Tesla, I think is going to be risk that you have to live with. But here's my advice to you. Don't put all of your money in your portfolio in Tesla, because then you're at the mercy of these tweets. When I owned Tesla, thank God, it was one of 53 stocks. Otherwise, I'd have gone insane over those 7 months. So you're right, Tesla has a lot of risk, but I'll tell you one of the issues with Tesla. I'm not sure what company Tesla is. You know what I mean by this? Is it an automobile company, an auto tech company, or a tech company? That's where you might decide to use a different bottom-up beta for Tesla than you would for Volkswagen or Ford. And that's a fair debate, because you're saying, what kind of market risk will I face in Tesla? Maybe it'll be more like investing in Microsoft than it will be investing in Volkswagen. And that's a healthy debate to have.
Another follow-up question. So we were doing this other company which had 50% revenues from A and 50% from B, very different. Can you put like different industries in your beta calculation? Like put calculate industry-specific betas for A industry, B industry, give weights based on revenue and get like a composite beta?
Now, how would you construct, so when you say...
Let us say a very large company which does 60% of automobile and 40% is tech.
Tech. Yeah, you could use a tech average, but that would you...
I use the tech average and the automobile average and put 60-40 weights.
Exactly. And you could even change it over time. So if you feel that Tesla will become more of a... I'll give you an example. Take Peloton, right? Peloton, you could argue, is in two businesses. It's in the fitness equipment business and it's in the subscription app business. It's like a Spotify, Netflix. Okay? You could actually take the weights of the two businesses. Right now, the weights are about 80% fitness, 20% fitness equipment. But you could say after this COVID effect that it might become 60% subscription, 40% fitness equipment as you go over time. You can even change the weights over time. So now let's talk about what you found as your betas. Now so this was the betas you reported, your regression betas. Your average regression beta is 1.10, your median is 1.05. So which makes sense, right? Median beta across all companies. The high beta that you've estimated, that you reported, or at least put in your Google Shared spreadsheet, was 2.36, the low is 0.13. There were no negative betas, but on a regression beta, you can sometimes get companies with negative betas simply because of noise and strange things happening to your company. In terms of the Jensen's alpha, here's what you found. Your median company had a Jensen's alpha of 1.81%. You know what that tells me? You're already not picking randomly across, and that was my fault. What did I tell you you should not pick for this project, or some of you decided to override me? I said, don't pick, do you remember? Two groups of companies I said to avoid. One was
money-losing companies.
What was it?
Another was loss-making companies.
Money-losing companies. So you see what I've done? I've skewed you away from the disaster companies, which means you're going to see a positive Jensen's alpha across your group. That actually makes sense. In fact, every semester I've taught this class, 42 semesters, you know, I've got a median Jensen's alpha. No, I might have frozen up a little bit. I've got a median Jensen's alpha of about 1.5 to 2%. So your typical company is riskier than average, has done better than average. 67% of your companies, you know, it says percent positive, negative. I actually reversed it. It should be 67% were positive, 33% were negative Jensen's alphas. Okay. Emily? You have a question, yes. Or you might just open?
Yeah, a question. So yeah. If you use the information from the Bloomberg beta page to calculate the Jensen's alpha, it is already annualized, right?
No. Bloomberg beta page is a weekly return beta. So the intercept is a weekly return intercept. So that has to be multiplied by 52 or raised to the power of 52, but that's just a weekly intercept.
Very cool, thanks.
Don't worry, if you put that in, you can go back and fix it. In terms of R-squared, your average R-squared was about 25%, your median was about 21%. So the typical company that you picked had about 75 to 80% firm-specific risk, and that's exactly why. I find it strange when people say, pick four or five stocks. That's hubris. To go out and not diversify is begging for trouble. You know what? People say, well, you can't, well, I want to pick stocks. Well, you can pick stocks and diversify. Why does it have to be an either or? The penalty you pay for not being diversified is so large that I cannot think of a good reason to stay concentrated. I know Mark Cuban says you shouldn't diversify, and Warren Buffett might have it some. I don't think Warren Buffett has said that. He's too sensible to say that. But I think people out there who are supposedly big investors give this advice, but staying concentrated is terrible advice given how much of the risk is company specific. Any questions on the regression beta calculations? Let's talk about the cost of capital. The cost of equity that we just computed goes into cost of capital calculation. But there are two other numbers you need for the cost of capital. One is the cost of debt, and the other is the market value weights for debt and equity. Let's talk about the market value weights first. If you have a publicly traded company, this was easy, right? The equity was a market cap. So technically, and I didn't ask you to do this, but technically the value of the management options that the company is granted should be treated as part of equity as well. Nobody does it. It doesn't make much of a difference in most companies. But if you have a young company with a lot of options, keep that in mind. Market value of equity is supposed to include that. Your debt should include all contractual commitments, in particular leases. We talked a big deal about leases, convert them to debt. Luckily for most of you, your companies have already started doing it. Just don't double count. Don't count the lease debt that accountants have done and compute the present value of leases, because that will be double counting. So that's a market value weights. And the weights obviously have to add up to 100%. Incidentally, some of you had preferred stock and convertible debt, a pain in the neck. I said if preferred stock is a very small number, just ignore it. But if it's a big number, if it's 20, 30% of your capital, you have no choice but to create a third component in your cost of capital. And convertible debt, if you have the time and the resources, it's good to break the convertible debt into debt and equity parts. If not, throw it all into debt. So that's a market value weights for debt and equity. For the cost of debt, here's what I said you needed to do. You needed to think about the rate at which you can borrow money long-term today. Keywords there, long-term and today. So to get to a cost of debt, I said start with the risk-free rate and come up with a default spread. There are two ways you can come up with a default spread. One is you can get lucky. Your company might have a bond rating already. Remember, for Disney, I had an A-minus rating. I can use that rating to come up with a typical default spread. Incidentally, that default spread you should have been using, and if you know, and it's not a big deal if you kept the default spreads at what they were in January, February, but they've doubled during this crisis. So that's why I gave you the updated spreads. So if you've been using my spreadsheets, they use the updated spreads, and those spreads are twice what they were just 2.5 to 3 months ago. So that's if you have an actual rating. If you don't have an actual rating, I suggest you compute a synthetic rating. Sounds magical, but we did something very simplistic. We started with the interest coverage ratio, operating income divided by interest expense. We used to lookup table to come up with a rating for the company. Well, some of you, this is where if you didn't listen to me and you picked a money-losing company, or your company, you listened to me and the company actually changed under you and became money-losing. You had an issue, right? The issue was your operating income is negative. You cannot compute a synthetic rating. Then what do you do? Well, you're valuing a company as a going concern or treating your company as a going concern. My suggestion is don't give them a D rating because that doesn't make any sense. I would give them at least a double B, maybe even a single B rating and move on if your company is money losing. But if your company is money making, try to come up with a synthetic rating, come up with a default spread. And remember, the cost of debt you need is an after-tax cost of debt. So what do you need to do? You need to multiply by 1 minus the marginal tax rate. I said, you know, there are lots of gains you can pay with the marginal tax rate. My suggestion was just take the market you're primarily in. So if you're a U.S. company getting 40, 50, 60% of your revenues in the U.S., just use the U.S. marginal tax rate. So even multinationals will park their debt in big market with a high tax rate. Pick a marginal tax rate for that country. Make that the marginal tax rate in computing your after-tax cost of debt. Any questions? So here's what you found when you looked at the current debt ratios for your companies. And remember, your measure of debt already should be including leases. So if you've been, so what you found across your companies was an average debt ratio of about 24% and a median debt ratio of about 20%. Remember earlier I said this is selection bias. You pick companies that had positive Jensen's alphas, slightly higher risk than the average company. Now you've added third dimension. The companies you were picking tended to be lightly levered, a lot more tech companies and manufacturing companies. And you see that reflected here. Doesn't mean that some of you didn't have companies with very high debt ratios. There's actually one company where the current debt ratio is more than 90%. You see, that's crazy. You know what probably happened, and I should take a closer look, was it was probably a travel company, an airline, where the market cap has collapsed. Because remember, you use the current market cap, and basically your debt ratio reflects that problem. So there are a few high debt ratio companies, but most of your companies are pretty lightly levered. And in terms of cost of capital, the reason that I asked about the cost of capital was I wanted to give you a number you could use to make a judgment on the quality of your investments. We could, if you think about making a judgment, you can you can do it right and do the net present value, but who has the resources to actually do that? I said use a shortcut. The shortcut is look at an accounting return. That accounting return can either be return on overall capital, after tax operating income divided by book value of equity plus debt minus cash invested capital, or return on equity, net income divided by book value of equity. And then what you do is you compare your return on capital to your cost of capital and your return equity to cost of equity. I should have added even more caveats than I did, but when I talked about return on capital and cost of capital in class, I explained also why you should be skeptical. These are accounting numbers and they can sometimes give you strange looking answers. You know, while you were listening to this in the abstract in class, it probably didn't register, but when you started doing this for your company, you learned a few problems with accounting returns. Like what? I think at least 30 of your companies, 30 out of the 260 companies analyzed, or 250 companies analyzed, had negative book equities. How can book equity can get negative? Either because you lost money in previous periods while starting book equity, or more likely, your company's been doing a lot of buybacks. In fact, some of you have strange looking returns on equity and capital. and you were trying to do gymnastics, trying to get negative numbers to positive by doing things like, hey, maybe I should leave goodwill in there. Remember, we have to work really hard to get your number to be positive, then it probably is not a meaningful number to begin with. So sometimes when you look at accounting returns, the conclusion you got to make is it's not meaningful. I'm just going to move on. And that's completely okay. So when you looked at your return on capital, here's what you found. You can add this on to the list of characteristics of a typical project company in corporate finance. Your median company delivered a 4% spread over the cost of capital. So this is return on capital minus cost of capital. You know why that's already unusual? I don't know whether you remember, but earlier in this class, I showed you the return spreads across all companies globally. And 60% of global companies earn less than their cost of capital. If you pick the median global company, its return on capital, it's going to be less than its cost of capital. So again, the selection bias is showing up. You're picking good companies over bad companies. Again, that doesn't surprise me. Your median spread was about 4%. In fact, 25% of your companies, even with the selection bias, did earn less than your cost of capital. By the first quartile, you were already at minus 0.35%. So tell me, many of your companies are earning returns higher than your cost of capital. But remember that this is a platform. This is not the end of your analysis. Because the question I asked you, based on that spread is, hey, what can you tell me about future projects? Now you could be mechanical and say, well, if I earn more than my cost of capital historically, then I'm going to continue to earn that in the future. But you can see how dangerous that statement is. You got to look at your business, how it's changing. You have to look at your competitive advantages. Corporate finance is about looking forward, not backwards. So it delivers the numbers from the past, but it says, look, what can this tell you about the company in the future? So look for some richness in this number compared to the industry averages. Look at your history, but make a judgment about what's going to happen to your company in the future. Any questions relating to accounting returns? So now we come to capital structure. And here's where I gave you the black box. Please don't let it stay a black box. Even if you used it as a black box for this class, take it apart, put it back together, because there's nothing magical happening on in that optimal capital structure spreadsheet. I'm just doing in a spreadsheet what I did by hand in class for Disney. So I asked you to compute the optimals. In this graph, I have your actuals, which you've already seen in the blue columns. Your optimals are in the green. The median optimal debt ratio that you came up with is about 30 to 35%, I think. See, a typical company in this class had a 30 to 35% optimal. I also asked you to compare actual to your optimal. And I was actually a little surprised here, though I shouldn't have been, which is that your median company had an actual debt ratio. So if you look at the median, almost exactly at the optimal. So there's almost no difference between your actual and optimal. On average, your actual debt ratio was about 2% less than the optimal, slightly underlevered. But you can see that, in fact, I think typically when I've done this in my classes, leading up to 2018, I used to find the typical US company underlevered by about 10 to 15%. Since in 2018, 2019, and 2020, that difference seems to have gone away. In other words, a typical US company no longer looks underlevered. It looks close to fairly levered. And if next year's numbers come in as badly as we think it will, I wouldn't be surprised if they got overlevered. You know what happened, right, in 2017 that's causing the shift. Anybody want to guess?
Could the marginal tax rate decrease?
So the marginal tax rate in 2017 that people are using for the US is 40%. Try this out for your company. Now, don't mess with your project report, obviously. Go into your optimal capital structure spreadsheet, put in the old 40% tax rate and see what happens to your optimal. You're going to be surprised, or maybe not that surprised, to see your optimal pop up. Colin, when you say actual versus optimal in a matrix, You could do that. Actually, that's not a bad idea. Maybe that's how I'll present it next semester, where you can see actuals on one axis, optimal on another, and actually plot the companies. That's actually a good idea. I'll do that, take that advice next semester. But It's interesting that you're almost at the optimal, and this is with 2019 operating, right? So can somebody tell me where the what you see as danger for companies? If you are correctly levered with 2019 operating income, you can already see what 2020 is going to bring you. It's going to bring you some negative surprises. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see a lot of leverage-related problems in the next year or two, because you don't want to go into a crisis correctly levered. You want to go into crisis with buffer, and it looks like U.S. companies have no buffer. Maybe I'm reading too much into just 250 companies, but that's, you know, that doesn't make me happy. There's no buffer built into at least the median company. And I think that, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the next year will deliver. Any questions? Now, notice though that even though the median company is correctly levered, there are some over-levered companies and some under-levered. I would be, if you're a company, I'd much rather be in this half of the graph than this half, but clearly, you know, lots of differences. On the right kind of financing, I didn't ask you for anything on the Google Shared spreadsheet, but I said start with the intuition, which is the most sensitive, you know, and the intuition is tell me what a typical project looks like for your company and build debt based on that project. If your typical project is long-term, then your debt should be long-term. If your projects throw off cash flows in euros, your debt should be in euros. If you have pricing power, you need floating rate debt. If you're a growth company with all of your cash flows in the future, use convertible debt. But we did go through this macro analysis. Remember where we looked at how sensitive your firm value and operating income were changes to interest rates. And we said the slope of that line tells you something about the duration of your assets and therefore the duration of your debt. Now, I gave you a spreadsheet and I said, try it if you want, but I also warned you that when you try the spreadsheet in your company, you might get strange looking numbers because it's just a very small sample and there's a lot of noise in your judgments. But you know, my objective is to start doing this just like I do bottom-up betas by sectors so that you can have a number that you can at least compare your company to. When you think about how long-term should my debt be, should it be fixed or floating rate, what currency? Because these, looking at how your company moves in relation to macro variables is, I think, a big part of creating flexible debt. And speaking of flexible debt, I think it's only a matter of time before somebody comes up with a version of debt for an airline, which brings in this sensitivity to something like because clearly this is not going to be the last pandemic in our lifetime. And we can already see the havoc that it wreaks on travel companies. So it'll be interesting to see how the debt for airlines evolves after this, because you know, if I were advising airlines, first thing I'd advise them to do is borrow less money, right? If you take those aircraft leases, don't add on to the additional debt. Second, try to figure out ways to make that debt more flexible. And one of the things I try to build into that debt is this risk of a shock to travel. And maybe that's doable. So we'll say, any questions before we move on to dividend policy? So let's talk about dividends. And dividends, I said, you know, one of the key things to look at is what can your company actually return? And the way you compute that is, it's not rocket science. You take the statement of cash flows. You start with net income, you subtract out all non-cash working capital changes, you subtract out reinvestment needs, you subtract out debt payments. And if you're borrowing new money, you bring that cash in. I mean, the way I described this in class was think of being the owner of a business. This is the cash left in the till after you've met every conceivable need. We call that free cash flow equity. Recognizing that free cash flow equity can be negative for high growth companies with lots of reinvestment needs. And I said, your job in dividend policy is to compare what gets returned in the form of dividends and buybacks to that free cash flow equity. So here's what you found. This is, it says dividends versus free cash flow equity. It's dividends plus buybacks as a percent of free cash flow equity. Remember, if you, this number, if it's 100%, means you're returning what you can afford to. If it's less than 100%, means you're accumulating cash. If it's more than 100% means you're returning more than you can have, which means you're either drawing down cash balances from the past or you're borrowing money. So your median company was returning about 56% of its free cash or equity in cash, which means it's building up a cash balance. So as you look around you at companies and see 30, 50, $80 billion cash balances, you can see why. There are companies in your sample which are returning way more than they should be in terms of free cash or equity. It doesn't make them irrational or weird, because it could be just that they're under-levered and they're just using dividends to catch up on leverage, or they just had a bad year if you're looking at 1 year. That's why I said look across time, because in any 1 year, strange things can happen. Now, if you look at this left column, and there's a lot of companies, a lot of those companies return no cash. I think about 30%, maybe not that high, 20% of your companies paid no dividends and bought back no stock. And they had free cash flows equity that were positive. Again, doesn't make them weird companies. They're just building up cash balances. So if you ask me to describe your typical project company in this class, it's probably a riskier than average company that has done better than average, both in terms of stock price performance and picking projects, is correctly levered, and is holding back cash. Hey, you know, you were looking at Netflix. Why should I be surprised? 9 of you picked Netflix. So you can already see, looking at that list, that there's a selection bias that's driving your results. Which brings me to my last piece of the project. And I want to spend some time here because I want to catch up on some of the slides I did not cover in the last session. I said when you sit down to value a company, you have to make a choice. You have to decide whether you're going to value it based on equity or the firm. If you decide to value equity, then you're going to estimate cash flows left over after debt payment, free cash flows equity. You're going to estimate a growth in equity income, and you're going to discount the cost of equity, and you get a value for equity. Or I said you can value the entire business. What does that mean? You have to look at pre-debt cash flows, free cash flow of the firm. And so you can see I start with after-tax operating income, sort of net income. I subtract out all of the reinvestment, not just the equity portion of the reinvestment, to come up with free cash flow of the firm. The growth rate I look at is growth rate and operating income. And the shortcut we use there is we look at how much are you reinvesting, how well are you reinvesting, and we discount all of those cash flows, free cash flows back at the cost of capital. What I get as a present value is the value of the operating assets. If you discount free cash flow to the firm at the cost of capital, which is where I push most of you to go, if you use my spreadsheet, then in a sense, your job has just begun. And let me explain. In the old, if you go back 40 years, the only valuation model that people ever talked about was the dividend discount model. And one of the nice things about the dividend discount model is you discount dividends per share at the cost of equity. What you get as the present value is the value per share. You are done. When you move to free cash flow to equity models, you generally don't do it on a per share basis. You discount free cash flows to equity at the cost of equity. You get the total value of equity in your company. You're saying, what's the big deal? That equity belongs to me as a stockholder. Hey, not so fast. If your company has been granting options to its managers, I'll have to subtract out the value of those options, because that value doesn't belong to you as a stockholder before dividing by the number of shares. So it's one extra step when you do the free cash or equity model, is you have to subtract out equity options. But if you do free cash flows the firm, God help you, because your work just began. And here's why. You discount free cash flows of the firm at the cost of capital. You have valued only those assets whose income is part of operating income. You say, what are you talking about? You know what else? What assets are not counted yet? If you are valuing Apple, discounting free cash flow of the firm at the cost of capital, you haven't valued the cash that Apple has. You're saying, what's the big deal? It's $250 billion. That's not penny change. The income from cash and marketable securities is not part of your operating income. So when you discount free cash of the firm at the cost of capital, you need to add cash and marketable securities. But that's not all. If you're valuing Tata Motors, you know what you haven't valued yet? Tata has cross holdings in Tata Steel, Tata Chemicals, Tata Consulting Services. You haven't valued those yet. Why? Because the income from minority holdings in other companies don't show up as part of operating income. When you're valuing an Asian or Latin American company, those cross holdings are a nightmare. I call them the black hole of valuation, because there's very little information given, and often you're given just the book value of those cross holdings. You've got to add those value. You, in a perfect world, you'd like the market value, but because you don't have it, you might have to take book value. then you subtract out debt outstanding. Why? Because you're interested in the value of equity. And just as with present value of free cash flow equity, you have to subtract out the value of equity options. I do an entire session in the valuation class on what I call the loose ends in valuation. These are the loose ends, and these loose ends can get you into serious trouble. Obviously, we don't have the time in this class to spend a lot of time on those loose ends, but be careful when you get to those loose ends, because they can comprise a big chunk of value. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to take two companies from my sampling and take you through the valuation to illustrate a couple of mechanical components as well as conceptual issues of valuation. The first valuation I'm going to show you is a dividend discount model valuation of Deutsche Bank from early 2008, the days of innocence when I valued banks using a dividend discount model. So to value Deutsche, here's what I did. I started with the normalized income. You know, remember Deutsche's income kept going up and down. 2007, they made a lot of money, but I thought that was not prudent to use the 2007 income because it was, I thought, too high. So I averaged the income out across 5 years. And I looked at the dividends in 2008. When you normalize the income and you look at dividends, the payout ratio you get is about 54%. I'm going to keep that payout ratio as the payout ratio for the near term, for the next 5 years. If you remember in the days of innocence, I thought Deutsche could continue to grow for the next 5 years. I was hopelessly wrong in hindsight, but in early 2008, I thought they could continue to grow. At what rate? With a payout ratio of 54%, they're retaining about 46%. They were making a normalized return on equity of 11.8%. So retention ratio times return equity gives me a growth rate of 5.4%. I'm not going crazy with the growth rate, but I'm giving them a 5.4% growth rate. So if you look at what I project for the next 5 years, here's what I have. I have the expected net income, the expected dividends, and I'm discounting those expected dividends. And the dividends are basically an income, are both growing at 5.4%. I'm discounting them back at the cost of equity I estimated for Deutsche Bank in early 2008 of 9.23%. The present value of just my dividends for the next 5 years is 9.65 billion euros. So I've taken the present value of dividends for the next 5 years. Am I done? Hey, not quite. You know why? Because what happens after year five? The company continues, right? And to bring in what happens after year five, I'm going to make an assumption. I'm going to assume that after year five, the company is going to be in stable growth. When it goes to stable growth, I'm going to assume that the cost of equity will decrease. Why? Because the company becomes stable. I've got to give it the benefits of being stable. It's not a huge shift. The cost of equity goes from 9.23% to 8.5%. But I've also made the assumption that as a stable bank, Deutsche Bank's return on equity will be equal to its cost of equity. This is not a hopelessly uplifting story for Deutsche. For the next 5 years, they're going to continue to grow at a pretty low rate, 5.4%. After year five, they're going to become a stable firm and they're going to earn their cost of equity. And I made the assumption that after year five, this was, remember, valuation in 2008 when the risk-free rate was 4% in euros, I'm going to assume that the growth rate is going to be 3% a year forever. So I've got 5.4% growth for the next 5 years, 3% thereafter. 9.23% cost of equity for the first 5 years, 8.5% thereafter. No. And I compute terminal value at the end of the fifth year by taking my expected dividends in year six. And to get the expected dividends in year six, I first compute my net income in year six. That's income in year five growing at 3%. And I multiply by my payout ratio after year five. You see, how do you get that? Remember, I assumed a 3% growth rate with an 8.5% cost of equity. To sustain a 3% growth rate with an 8.5% cost of equity, I can afford to pay out 64.7%. What I'm trying to emphasize is I see a lot of discounted cash flow valuations where you get to year 5 or year 10. The company's put in stable growth, but then nothing else changes. But everything should change, right? If your growth changes, your cost of equity will change, your payout ratio will change, and my terminal value reflects my new payout ratio, my new growth rate, and my new cost of equity, 62.3 billion euros. So here's what I have. I have the expected dividends for the next 5 years, which I've already taken a present value of. I have a value at the end of the fifth year. There's one final piece to this puzzle, right? That's at the end of year five. My value today will be the present value of the terminal value. And here's where there's a mechanical point I want to emphasize. Notice that to get my terminal value, I use my 8.5% cost of equity. To discount it back today, I revert back to the cost of equity I had for the first 5 years. And here's why. I've got to live through those first 5 years to get to my terminal value. So it's a risk over those 5 years that I have to reflect. So my terminal value gets discounted back at my current cost of equity, 9.23%. Gives me a present value of 40.079 billion. I add that on to my present value from the previous page, 9.65 billion. I get 49.7 billion as my value of equity. Deutsche had no options outstanding. And because it's a dividend discount model, I wouldn't have had to deal with it anyway. I divide by the number of shares. The value per share I'd have got for Deutsche is 105 euros per share. Stock was trading at 89. God, thank God I didn't buy these shares. You know what they're trading at now? Anybody have any idea what Deutsche is trading at now? Rizwan, I'll come back to you, but it's trading at about 6 euros per share. God help you. No. But Deutsche has been one, it's been like the Titanic hitting multiple icebergs along the last 10 years. But a pure dividend discount model, you can already see. Rizwana? Rizwana?
My question is...
Go ahead.
My question is around the beta being zero, being equal to one in the steady state. Why do we assume that it will move to one in the steady state?
What do we assume mature companies are? Now, if I give you a choice, you know, if you're a mature company, it's close to average, above risk average. I mean, the essence of a mature company is you've got to move towards the average. It doesn't have to be exactly one. It could be 1.1 or 0.9. But it, to me, it doesn't make sense for you to tell me that your company is going to become a mature company and have a beta 1.5 or 1.8. So one doesn't have to be the beta for every company in stable growth, but it should be moving towards one.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions on the Deutsche valuation? Okay, so let me do my Disney valuation. So we're going to have some fun here because Disney, we've been looking at all through the semester. We know enough about Disney that we can make some informed choices. So here's what I did. For the next 5 years, I assumed that Bob Iger would run Disney. This was 2013. So I assumed that their tax policies wouldn't change. So their effective tax rate would drive their operating income and the marginal tax rate would be 36%. I assumed they would continue to take projects similar to the project they'd been taking, 12.6%. And they'd be reinvesting like they did in 2013. Think of this as a status quo. Continued return on capital, continued reinvestment. You're saying, why do you care about the return on capital and reinvestment rate? Their growth rate during these 5 years is just going to be the product of their return on capital and their reinvestment rate. That pushes the growth rate to 6.8%. Their debt to cap ratio, I'm going to assume stays at 11.5%. You're saying, but you assume the, but you estimate an optimal of 40%. Hey, I'm not running the company. Bob Iger is, and he, maybe he doesn't like to increase the debt ratio. So I left the debt ratio at 11.5%, which leaves their cost of capital at 7.81%. So for the next 5 years, things continue the way they are. Similar returns on capital, similar reinvestment rate, similar debt ratio, similar cost of capital. Then I move to after year 10. You say, what about the transition phase? You're going to see the transition phase does itself. What happens after year 10? Well, after year 10, I'm going to assume that Disney becomes a mature company. What happens when it becomes a mature company? I'm going to assume that its growth rate is going to drop to 2.5%. Why 2.5%? Well, remember the growth rate has to be less than the risk-free rate. The risk-free rate, the time that I did this was 2.75%. So I dropped it to 2.5%. When my growth rate drops, my reinvestment also becomes a lower number. It's 2.5% divided by a return on capital that I think will be lower than it is today. You say, but how do you know? It's my judgment. Valuation is about making your best judgments. I'm going to assume it's going to come down, but not all the way down to the cost of capital. So here's what I see. For the next 5 years, the company is going to grow at 6.8% a year. After year 10, it's going to grow at 2.5% a year. For the next 5 years, it's going to reinvest 54% of its after-tax operating income. After year 10, it's going to reinvest 25%. For the next 5 years, the return on capital is 12.6%. After year 10, it's 10%. You say, what about the transition period? Yeah, I'm not going to play games in the transition period. You know what happens in the transition period? I move my numbers from a high growth phase down to my stable growth phase in linear increments. What does that mean? If I want to get from 12.6 to 10, I take the difference, 2.61% divided by 5. And then I go 12.61, 12.09. Basically, I take equal steps every year. You see, that's not very scientific. Guilty as charged. If you want to make this much more sophisticated, you can do so, but it won't affect your value that much. When you want to move numbers, take the simplest path you can. So over time, the company is going to become a lower growth company and a lower cost of capital company. And my valuation in November of 2013 reflects those judgments. Now, I don't like Excel spreadsheet valuations. I like pictures. And this is my picture for Disney's valuation. And there should be a lot of familiar numbers here. Why? Because these are the numbers we've been working with all semester. See this debt ratio of 88.5% and 11.5%? That was the debt ratio we computed for Disney in part one, when we did the investment analysis. See the beta of 1.0013? That was my bottom-up beta for Disney. If you don't believe me, go back and look at page 77 or page 147 of packet one, where we broke Disney down into five businesses. The equity risk premium reflects the parts of the world Disney operates in. The risk-free rate is the dollar risk-free rate. This is the cost of capital we've been using for Disney all through the class. The reinvestment rate and the return on capital came from looking at Disney as a company over time. The growth rate reflects those choices. The bottom line is with these numbers, I'm telling you a story about Disney. What's the story? Of a company that has significant competitive advantages but moderate growth prospects that over time will become a stable company, which will continue to earn above the cost of capital because its competitive advantages, especially that Mickey, the characters, the connections it's built to children over time are not going to fade after year 10. But the end game here is with my judgments, what I end up with is free cash flows for the next 10 years. A gigantic number at the end of year 10. That's always the elephant in the room. That's what I think Disney will be worth at the end of year 10. Discounted back to debt at the cost of capital for Disney. Remember, the cost of capital does shift over time. And what I get as a present value for the operating assets with those cash flows is $126 billion. I add cash. Why? Because I haven't counted it yet. Non-operating investments. This, I think, was Disney's portion of their Hong Kong theme park, because they were not allowed to own a majority stake by the Chinese government. So it was actually treated as a minority holding. So that's a $2.85 billion. I subtract out debt. Minority interest reflects a consolidated holding of portions of companies where Disney owns less than 100%. So this is the portion of the company that doesn't belong to them. So mopping up. These are the loose ends. I come up with a value for equity of $113.6 billion. I subtract out options, not a big deal for Disney, but it does have options outstanding, the management options. The value of these options as options is $972 million. I divide by the number of shares. The value per share that I got for Disney was $63 per share. The stock was trading at about 68. It's slightly undervalued, but if you think about the value, the estimates I had to make, if you think about the bound on the value, I'd have said in November 2013, Disney was close to fairly valued, maybe slightly overvalued. Rukshan?
I just had a question on why you, if unless I'm wrong, you didn't use or impute your optimal capital structure into this valuation over the long term.
Remember, when you value companies as, I'm valuing Disney as a passive investor, right? I'm buying 1,000 shares of Disney. How much control do I have about what Disney borrows?
None.
If I were acquiring Disney, I could use a target debt ratio. I'm always worried when equity research analysts use target debt ratios, because my question is, you're not running the company. John Chambers is running Cisco. You can't go in and put a debt ratio. That's why I've held back on moving towards a 40% optimal. Is I don't run the company, so I can't put that number in and act like I control the debt ratio. So I held back on it because I think Disney's management is a little conservative on debt, and I think it's a good thing because we see what happens to companies that overreach on debt, and I'm going to bring that into my valuation as a passive investor.
Okay, thank you.
Jane?
For the minority interest and the option, Are those book numbers or market numbers?
Minority interest, I had to use book value because there was absolutely no information. In a perfect world, everything should be a market number, right? So the non-operating investments was cross-holding for minority interest. The options are a market number because I valued the options using the current stock price and an option pricing model. But the minority interest in the non-operating investments here, unfortunately, are just book value numbers.
And just to follow on that, if you already subtracted the minority interest from your net income, will you still have to do this?
If you were doing net income, you wouldn't be doing free cash flow to the firm in the first place, right? You'd be doing free cash flow to equity, and then you wouldn't have to. That's why when you do free cash flow to equity valuations, you won't see minority interest. But you're then hoping that your net income captures the effect, right? Because can you imagine doing this at SoftBank? What's SoftBank's biggest holding? In fact, what's the biggest chunk of SoftBank's value come from?
Alibaba.
It's Alibaba Holdings. And if I valued it based, I assume the net income for SoftBank captures it, I'd be in serious trouble. So that's why it's often better to keep these separate, because I think you need to value them separately. And if you have the information, value them from scratch. Sam?
Yeah, I have a question following up on Rukshan's point about the debt to equity ratio at the optimal level. In case of like a more extreme example in which a company is overlevered and that's hurting value as opposed to maybe
you have to bring it down, but then because in a sense you're telling a story of your company being a healthy company going on forever, I think it's prudent then to bring it down to the optimal, because or at least towards the optimal or towards the industry average. Because otherwise the company will go bankrupt, then you will never get to term.
Would it be double counting to also bring it into the risk of failure?
If you're doing a valuation, no. You won't be double counting because that lowering the debt ratio is also going to lower your cost of capital, right?
Sorry.
So in a sense, you're giving them the benefit of becoming a healthy company in your DCF, but then you're saying there's a chance it might not happen.
Right, that's what okay, perfect. And then the next question is, I noticed on your terminal value check spreadsheet that if the ROIC in perpetuity is greater than the starting cost of capital, you have that as
the point I'm trying to make, it's very difficult for companies to make more than their cost of capital forever. So my default assumption when I sit down to value a company is after year 10, which is when I put you into stable growth, your return on capital, your competitive advantage is not going to last more than 10 years. But if you're valuing a Coca-Cola or an Apple or a Facebook, you can push back. And that's why I give you or the option of changing that assumption. But you sparingly, right? Don't set it at 25% return on capital forever. No company, no matter how great, makes that higher return on capital.
Yeah. Sorry, I guess I just want you to know that I think in that spreadsheet you have the, I'll just take it offline, but I think there's a missing link, but I'll email you about it.
I think there is a question I ask as a default question. If you said, no, you don't want to change the default, then it'll converge on the cost of capital. If you said yes, go back and check whether you said yes or no to that question. If you said yes, then I'm going to push you towards a higher return capital.
Got it. All right. Thank you.
Rukshan? I'm sorry. Chad?
I think that's from previous.
Oh, go ahead. Either of you.
So I had one other question on the debt to equity ratio. So the company that I had been looking at had a fairly dramatic drop off in share price, which pushed the debt to equity ratio a lot higher. And so then when I'm doing bottoms up betas, all of a sudden the bottoms up beta gets pushed up much higher because of the debt to equity. That increases the cost of equity, which decreases the value of the firm. So you actually have a situation where the market value of equity kind of cycles back and then influences the actual value of the firm. Does that make sense? Or is there a situation where
is your cost of capital change that dramatically? Because your cost of equity will be much higher, but your debt ratio will be much higher. Your cost of capital effect should be relatively small. Why is your cost of capital changing so much?
So I think the value of the equity dropped quite a bit relative to the...
But where's the cycling back effect? Your company is now riskier. It has a higher cost of capital. So don't you think that's if it's Korean Airlines and you told me the cost of capital is higher, I would want that effect to kick in to my value because it's a riskier company with lower cash flows. They're two separate effects, right?
So I think that makes sense. I guess I'm just asking when you're having a relatively large impact of like the market price of your equity.
I think what you're pointing to is the dangers of leverage, which is what happens is once you get into a problem, it's a spiraling problem. Your value can very quickly converge on zero, which is what's happening, right? Your discount rate goes up, your cash flows decrease, and each time it happens, you get into even worse trouble. And that's one of the reasons why you probably should hold back and pushing all the way towards an optimal and build a buffer in. But that can happen.
Gotcha. Makes sense. Thanks.
So here's what you found. You were a remarkably optimistic group. Now, basically, you found, I think, out of your company, 60% came out as undervalued. So the way to read this is the price relative to the value. So negative number means a typical company. So your typical company was about 6% undervalued. And about 64% of your companies came out as undervalued. So there you are. You are, in fact, the most optimistic group of the last, I don't know, compared to, now I didn't do all of them because the spreadsheet got too crowded, but you're much more optimistic than the Spring 2019 group. I don't want to read too much into it because in my valuation class, I got the exact opposite. So there's clearly a divide between this class and the valuation class. So something to keep in mind, you're finding a lot of undervalued companies. And here's your list of 10 most undervalued stocks. I don't know, remember lots of people are doing Netflix. So this was one of the people doing Netflix, found it to be undervalued by, who's the $364, I'm sorry, these are your most overvalued. I think I've got it reversed, I'm sorry. These are my most overvalued stocks. I should have pulled up the undervalued. I meant to pull the undervalued. I'll pull up the undervalued and see which one it is. So this is most overvalued stock. So Netflix was your most overvalued stock. There are a couple of Lululemons which are in the overvalued list. Wingstop, AMC. So I'm not surprised at this list of overvalued stocks, but I'd like to see the undervalued stock because some of this just reflects the fact that, you know, you're looking at companies that are, maybe I'd reverse this, maybe that's what it is. Maybe you did find overvalued. Let me go back and check because I was doing this in a hurry. So maybe this makes sense. Maybe you found more overvalued than undervalued stocks and I'm getting the minuses and the pluses reversed. Yeah, but I'll check that out. Finally, that brings me to changing value because by now, if you look at that discounted cash flow valuation, you can see things you can change. You can increase the cash flows. You can check to see whether your debt ratio is optimal. And remember when I evaluated Disney, I said the existing management runs a company, so I'm going to do nothing to the debt ratio, the return on capital. So there are ways I could change value, right? And if a new management came in, you could change the value. So with your company, I didn't ask you to do this, but you have the levers at your disposal. You could take better investments, have a better mix of debt and equity, maybe pay the right amount in dividends. And the way this plays out is in those inputs into discounted cash flow valuation. So I actually, remember earlier, Rukshan asked me, why didn't I go to the optimal? I did. But this is with me running the company. So if I were running the company, I'd push up to a 40% debt ratio. Their cost to capital would be lower. I'd be a little more selective about my acquisition, actually, you know, reinvest less and go for more payoffs in the gaming business, slightly higher return on capital. Not a huge increase in growth rate. I'm not going to be able to make Disney grow at 30% growth. I'd be overreaching. With that slightly higher growth rate and a tweaked optimal, the value that I get is about $75. You know what I got? Remember what I got with the status quo? I'll take you back. I think it was 62.56. With the changes put in, I get 75. What should I call that difference? 75 minus 63. Those of you in my valuation class, not fair answering because you know what I call this. But somebody not in my valuation class, I've got two values for Disney. 63 is my base case status quo value. 75 is with my changes put in. So that $12 difference, what should I call it?
Price target or intrinsic value?
It's your value. I'm sorry, what did you say, Richard?
I said, would it be a price target or so an intrinsic value?
They're both current values. This is your value of control. When people talk about control premiums, they often talk about, hey, 20%. That's absurd. The value control comes from the fact that you think you can run a company differently than the existing management. The value control at Disney is about $12 per share. If I gave you a perfectly managed, perfectly run company already, what's the value control going to be? It's going to be zero. Because when you revalue the company, you're running it, what are you going to change? The value control comes from the fact that you think you can change the company. So I looked at what I call my triple whammy list. This is my list of companies which are underlevered, which have a lot of cash building up and are also undervalued. You know why I do this? Because if you're an activist investor, these are the companies you want to target because, or even if you're a passive investor, you hope an activist will target it. This was my list of seven companies looking across your companies where you found that the company was undervalued, that they were returning less cash than they could and were underlevered. Micron Tech, so take this list, don't do anything crazy with it, but it's an interesting list. I own Southwest and Micron Technology from my list, so I feel good about seeing them on this list because I know this optimal debt ratio of 70% is way, way too high because we know Southwest operating income is going to crash and burn. But I think the fact that Southwest went into this crisis with debt capacity, that was returning less cash than it could have, that was also undervalued, might be a good thing if you're an investor. So think of this list as a kind of a target list if you're an activist investor, not that any of us has that much money to play with, but it's something to factor in. So it took us a long way to get to this final page, but remember this page from the first class? I said, no. Your investment decision, you want to invest in projects that earn a rate greater than your minimum acceptable hurdle rate, you know, optimal debt ratio, and the right kind of mix for your debt is the right kind of debt for your company is one that matches the kinds of assets you have. And how much cash you return should depend on what cash you have available, free cash or equity. Early on, if you'd never taken a corporate finance class, it looked like a lot of buzzwords. Hopefully you have the tools now to be able to address these principles and apply them to a company. And that's what you've done in the project. So if you remember, I said I had three objectives for the class, and I said I promised you at the very end of the class, I would come back and relist the objectives to see if I had accomplished them. I know it's up to you to answer this question because this matters to me more than the course evaluations, which I hope you've done in by the end of the week because I think you went through Friday. But I want you to think about whether these objectives got met. I said, if you get the big picture, the details will come. And what do I mean by that? You might still be struggling with equity risk premiums or bottom-up betas or the optimal debt ratio calculations. But think of the big picture of hurdle rates and the optimal debt ratio being the one that minimizes your cost of capital and maximizes value and not paying out more than you can afford. You can take care of the details, or better still, you can hire other people to do the details for you. But the big picture, I think that's what's lacking in corporate finance and practice is that capacity to see the big picture. We have too many specialists. Second, there are useful tools, but the tools are only useful if you can apply them to answer bigger questions. So looking at investor holdings just for looking at holdings doesn't make any sense, but looking at holdings to get a sense of where the power lies, that's why we look at the numbers. And I said, corporate finance is fun. This is not the right time for me to ask you, was it fun? Because I might be hitting a sore spot, but it wasn't so bad, was it? I think it's a pretty intuitive, common sense. No. So I hope the class has not been too painful. I know this is not the way I wanted this class to go. I wanted to see you in classroom so we could talk in person. And I wish we could have done that. But maybe next year, if you want the torture to continue an email every day for, 100 and something days, you can come back and visit me in the evaluation class and stay. But until then, no. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed having you in the class, and you still have the final exam to do, so don't check out too early. But after the exam is over, keep working on it. This is a work in progress. It's not ever quite done. You keep learning every time you pick a company to analyze. Rizwana? Sam, go ahead. Sam,
I don't think my mic's on.
Your mic's not on? I heard you. Okay, Rizwana?
Professor, for the final exam, what will be the format? How many questions will we have?
I'll have to check. It'll look very much like your quiz 2 and quiz 3. It'll be single standalone questions. I think there are 8 or 9. And you'll have 2 hours.
For a total of 8 to 9 questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
You have 5, I think, on the quizzes. So it'll be less. So it'll be 8 to 9 and 2 hours.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question too. Would we have similar timeline like quizzes from like 1 a.m. to like
2 p.m.? Yeah, in fact, I'll probably make it like 12. It'll be about a 12-hour. I make it a little longer than the quizzes because it's a 2-hour. So you'll have to start 2 hours before the end time. But there'll be plenty of time that day. It might even be 16 hours.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, and thank you very much, and I will see you soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Professor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.